In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, amen. By the grace of God, we're going to tackle this topic today, monasticism. We're going to go through some history, some of the monastic literature, and the spirituality. Okay? So, before I get started, I kind of split it up into three parts. Pre-monasticism, and then the monastic era, and then post-monasticism. So you're going to get like, that's the framework we're going to be working in. You're going to get like a little snapshot of what monasticism was before it actually was called monasticism, and then what we know monasticism to be. Like, if I say monasticism, what do you think right away? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Monastery.
Desert. What kind of, whose names come to your mind?
St. Anthony,
right? And that's all we really know, right? Once we say monasticism, we think St. Anthony, right? But there's more to it, and that's what we're going to get into today. And then we're going to talk about post-monasticism or contemporary monasticism, the monastic life today, okay? So, next. All right, so this is the background. Asceticism is a word that is used a lot in monastic literature. It's basically, ascetic practice is basically when somebody is strict and hard on themselves. They grow their hair out, they watch what they eat, they're very careful with everything, they're very accountable, they do all these things. They're very strict people. So when you see that word, that's basically what it means. So asceticism existed before monasticism, as we see in the lives of the Old Testament figures, such as the Nazarites. Nazarites were people who grew their hair out. They never took a razor or a scissor to their hair. They never cut their hair. Okay? Moses and Elijah and so on. So there's a lot of Old Testament figures where they were people that were very strict on themselves. Okay, John?
Is it like a thing to like grow the hair on your head? Like,
yes. In the Old Testament, it was fine. It was actually very common. But that's a good question. These days, it's like if you grow your hair out, it's like, why are you doing that? That's a problem, you know, stuff like that.
As a monk or as a normal person?
As a normal person. Okay, so the Essenes and the Therapeuti were ascetic Jewish sect. And it's the group that is St. John the Baptist was actually from. So in Judaism, before the church started, there was Jewish sects. So you had the Pharisees, you had the scribes, and the Essenes were one of these sects within Judaism. Okay? And they were ascetic people. The scribes were known for writing and transcribing the scripture. Okay? The Pharisees were known for being Pharisees, right? We know of them from the Bible. The Essenes were the sect that were known to be the ascetic Jews, the strict ones, the ones that lived in the desert, like St. John the Baptist. The Bible paints out a picture of St. John the Baptist as somebody who wore what? What did he wear?
Camel skin hair.
And what did he eat?
Honey.
And locusts and grasshoppers. So he has those characteristics of an ascetic person. Okay, so next. So that's before monasticism. So you see what I'm talking about? Those characteristics were in the lives of people. And then the church was established after the Lord Jesus Christ died on the cross and his disciples preached to the whole world. You had the church and it was established, and there was a long period of martyrdoms. Okay? Christians were getting killed. This picture is the Roman arena. Okay? And here you see Christians being put on crosses and burned. And you see a group of Christians there and the lion being released to attack them and kill them. Okay? And everybody would watch this for entertainment. Okay? This is how the early Christians were being martyred. Okay? And you might be asking, what does this have to do with monasticism? But you'll see where I'm going with this. I'm trying to take you from the Old Testament to St. John the Baptist, which is before the church was started, and now I'm taking you to the early church, and I'm going to take you to what we know as the monastic era. Okay? So, go next.
At the Colosseum.
Yeah. Next. So, monasticism is considered martyrdom. Question mark. The era of martyrdoms in the church was ending. Okay? And a new era of those who desire to die for him, the Lord Jesus Christ, emerged. Okay? These men, and women I should say, because there was women as well, saw a spiritual martyrdom. And we know these people as the monks. Does that make sense? Martyrdom in the early church ended. Like, it was slowly declining. So people sought to die for the name of Christ. This was the spirit. This was the energy that was in the church. Okay? So, this is what was happening. These men and women wanted to die spiritually, not physically. Does that make sense? Over here you have a picture of a monk being crucified. It's not really a picture of him being crucified, literally. He's being crucified in terms of crucifying his passions. Okay, that's what a monk is actually trying to accomplish. He's trying to get rid of lust. He's trying to get rid of anger. He's trying to get rid of all these things that get him separated from God. Does that make sense? So the monk enters a spiritual warfare. That's what he's doing. He's a soldier for God. Okay, he's entering the battlefield. And you're going to see exactly what I'm talking about when I move on in the lecture. Tony?
Yeah, would they get a crown of martyrdom?
Yeah. They will.
Like the same crown like St. George gets?
Well, the monastics have their own crown, and I'm pretty sure it's probably in the same level of the martyrs. Okay, so I'm going to read this, or I'll have somebody read it. Who wants to read? Tom.
His disciples said to him, "If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who are born thus from their mother's womb, and they are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it."
Okay, so you're probably thinking what this means. The word eunuch was given or was used for the people who would castrate themselves, and it was a way to prevent the slaves from messing around with the wives of the master, okay? And a main pillar of monasticism is what? Does anybody have an idea of what I'm talking about? One?
Celibacy?
Exactly, celibacy. Celibacy is like a pillar of the monastic life. A monk is one who is not married, okay? So this teaching exists here. In the Gospel of St. Matthew, you see here, it says, "For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb. And there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men." Okay, that's like what I just said, they would castrate them. "And then there's some who are eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake." Okay, it's in your nature to desire to be married, right? It's a normal thing. It's a very normal thing. But these men and women, they take the kingdom of heaven by force. So they willingly deny themselves. They go against who they are. So these people are not different. They actually choose to do this. They willingly and knowingly do this, and they take the kingdom of heaven by force. So that's the point I'm trying to make by showing you this verse. You could just take down the verse. You don't really have to. Next. This is what St. Paul has to say about chastity. Who wants to read this one?
"Not concerning the things of which you wrote to me. It is good for a man not to touch a woman, nevertheless because of sexual immorality. Let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with the consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment, for I wish that all men were even as myself.
One second. For I wish that all men were even as I myself. St. Paul was a celibate, so that's what he's saying there. I just wanted to say that. Sorry.
That's okay. But each one has his own gift from God, one in his manner, another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they are men even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion.
1 Corinthians 7:1-9. Okay? So, this is what St. Paul has to say about being married or unmarried. Okay? Next. Alright. So, when I first started the talk, I said monasticism, and I'm sure all of you jumped right to St. Anthony, right? So you see how I kind of did that pre-monastic tradition. I kind of gave you a little bit of a systematic lineup of what we know and how we got to monasticism. This is the famous verse which St. Anthony heard being read in the church when he decided to become the first monk. Okay? Jesus said to him, if you want to be perfect, go sell what you have. Give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. Matthew 19:21. Okay? So, next. I'm going to give you guys a handout. So, I had mentioned I wanted to do some monastic literature. So, I want you, if we're going to understand monasticism, we need to read monastic literature. That's the only way you're really going to understand what monasticism really is. Okay? Yeah, can you pass it up? So we can pass these out quickly. Yeah.
Isn't there a crown of celibacy? Or is that different from a crown of martyrdom? Like, don't they say sometimes, like, one saint receives 3 crowns, celibacy,
yes,
asceticism, and something else?
Yeah, there are multiple, there are different counts for different things. So I believe celibacy is one of those crowns as well. I've heard that being said before. I have to look into that some more. Okay, does everyone have one? No. Does everyone have one? So, we're on page 24. Okay. I'm going to read through this and I'm going to comment, and you'll get a better idea of what I'm trying to accomplish. Okay, so we're on page 24. And if you jump down, you'll see it titled The Struggle in the Tomb. I just want to tell you what this is. You probably don't know what this is. This is from a book called The Paradise of the Fathers. And it's a book that is a two-volume book. The first volume is on the lives of the monastics. And the second volume is on their stories. Okay? And sayings. Okay? And in one of these volumes is the life of Anthony by St. Athanasius, who was our Pope in the Coptic Church. So St. Athanasius was the one who wrote the life of St. Anthony. This is just an excerpt. This is just one little page out of that book, and it'll give you a glimpse of Anthony's life, okay? It'll give you a snapshot of St. Anthony's life, okay? So we're going to read through it, and I'm going to make some comments. So we're at the struggle in the tomb. And this is St. Athanasius talking about St. Anthony. So here we go. After these things, he passed into another frame of mind, and having decided within himself that he would go forth from the village, he departed and took up his abode in a tomb in the cemetery. So he decided to go into a cemetery, okay, which is situated in a mountain which lay close by the village. and he commanded one of his acquaintances to bring him a morsel of bread from time to time. And having done these things, and entered into the tomb, and shut the door upon himself, straightway the adversary, together with a multitude of devils, who were his associates, burst in upon him there, for he was afraid to let Saint Anthony go from the village altogether. And he began to say to him, "How great is that which you endure? To what limit will you drive yourself? You have come and have entered into the place of our abode." This is something that I want to comment on. You're going to see as I go on that if you've heard some monastic lectures before, they say the desert and the tombs are the place of demons, because the Lord pulls them out of the cities because the men of the world, men and women of the world, are not at that level to deal with demons the way we're going to see. So he keeps them away from the city or the village. This is God keeping them away for the sake of the other people. Okay, so Anthony is actually stepping into their territory. Okay, I'm going to take your question. What man is there who has ever done this? When was it ever heard that men ought to live among the tombs? We have been driven out of the village. That's just what I was just saying. The demons are telling St. Anthony, we were driven out of the village. We shall also be driven out from among the tombs. Why are they going to be driven out from the tombs? Because St. Anthony's there. You know, he's a man of God. Therefore, we will take vengeance upon you. The demons are telling him, or the devils are telling him, we're going to take vengeance upon you. For it is you who have made us fools. Then they began to smite him with blows. They physically beat him up. They smote him, and so severely that at length he fell on the ground, and nothing but his breath was left in him. St. Anthony used to relate that the blows with which the devil smote him were more severe than those of the children of men. God brought help to him and would not deliver him over to death, for he put it into mind of him that used to visit him to come quickly and to open the door of the tomb according to his custom. And he saw the blessed Anthony, who was similar to a dead man by reason of the blows. Straight away he lifted him up and brought him to the church in the village. There collected about him no small number of people, and they gathered together and sat by his side as if he had been a dead man. By the sweet rest of sleep, the blessed Anthony was refreshed, relieved from his affliction, came to himself, and turned round. He saw that all the people were asleep, that only his friend, who was sitting watching by his pillow, was awake. He made a sign to him, drew near to him, and said, "Anthony," said to him quickly, quietly, "come, do an act of righteousness, lest the heart of the people should think, and mankind should imagine that there is still power left in the evil one, and so be afraid to lift up the heel against him." The man hearkened to him, and whilst the people were quiet and asleep, he lifted him up and carried him to the tomb. So he brought him back. He convinced the guy to bring him back to the tomb after he was almost killed. Is that kind of mind-boggling? Or is that something very mind-boggling? But he was trying to make a point that he's not afraid of the devil, and he doesn't want the people to feel that he was overcome and beaten by Satan. So these are things we should derive hope, and we should derive a lot of like things from the lives of the saints. You see how he's not afraid of the devil? Okay? And shut the door as usual. And then St. Anthony prayed as he was lying down. So he continued praying as he was really tired and almost dead. For he had no power in him to stand up. And while he had multiplied his prayers, he said with a loud voice, "Where are you, O children of Gehenna? Here I am, even I, Anthony, and I will not depart from this place until you are destroyed in this place." For although you multiply tortures, I shall not be remote from the love of Christ. Then he said with a loud voice, though a whole legion of devils encamps against me, my heart shall not fear. These were the words which this man, this athlete, proclaimed in his striving. Then the heart of the enemy of righteousness melted within him, and he cried to the dogs of his kinsfolk, and spoke emitting smoke from himself, and he did so, saying to them, did you not say to me, what shall we do with this man, this insolent fellow, who has treated us wholly with contempt and disdain? His heart is not afraid of quaking terror. His hearing is not perturbed by words or voices. His eyes is not terrified by visions, and his body has no fear of blows. Who among you can give me counsel as to what shall be done with him? After which they contrived the following plan. It is very easy for the enemy to create apparitions and appearances, such a character that shall be deemed real and actual objects. Straight away, phantoms of this kind caused a phantom earthquake, and they tore apart the four corners of the house and entered into the bodily forms from all sides. One had the form of a lion, another had the appearance of a wolf, and another was a panther, and all the others were forms of serpents. You see this picture? Vipers and scorpions, the lion, the roaring, as a lion roars when he is about to slay. The bull was ready to gore him with his thorns. The panther was prepared to spring upon him, and the snakes and the vipers were hissing, and they appeared to be in an act of hurling themselves upon him. And the sounds which were made and the forms in which showed themselves were terrible. The blessed Anthony was not disturbed or frightened by their commotion, and in his mind remained wholly undisturbed. As he was lying down, he laughed at these phantoms and said, thus there is no power in you. You have taken to yourselves the forms of wild beasts, and if there had been any power whatsoever to do harm in you, only one would need to come against me, and this would have been sufficient. So he's saying, one of you could have taken me, but you're making all of this commotion just to like frighten me. So he knows like
they're bluffing.
Yeah, he knows they're bluffing, right? But because our Lord has cut off the things which incited you to attack me, and the provocation of your wickedness has no strength, you lay plots and contrive snares, thinking that perhaps you will be able to make men quake by fear only. Moreover, whoever has had experience of your feebleness know that you have obtained as helpers the mere forms and appearances of wild beasts. Anthony also spoke to him in a very great boldness of heart, saying, if you had indeed received power over me, or if it been your power to do me harm, do not hesitate to do it. Only draw near speedily and do whatever you lust to do. By the way, we just finished Kiyacht. I'm sorry, I'm going on some tangents. But in Kiyacht, we have an ode to St. Anthony, right? Do you hear some of this coming out in the hymnography? The church is actually teaching us this stuff. It's actually from here. That excerpt or that verse that was just mentioned above, why have you come with all these people? This is actually in the hymnography. Okay? I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Anyway, so you get the point. You guys could finish this up on your own time. But there's one more point I want to make. Later on in here, St. Anthony is... the Lord appears to St. Anthony, and he tells him, God, where were you? So the Lord tells St. Anthony, I was with you this whole time. So St. Anthony says, what do you mean? So this is the response of the Lord. Anthony, I wanted to see you struggle and win. I wanted to see you struggle and win. So sometimes God permits for us to go through some trial or tribulation or get, you know, a little shaken up in order that we feel victorious. It's almost like a parent empowering their child, you know? Like, they make them feel like they won something. But they really have the care and protection of who their parents.
Isn't it like if you do the sign of the cross, they just go away?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do it?
That usually is the case, but it's not always the case.
Why do the hermits, like, go to the desert if that's where the demons dwell? Isn't always supposed to run away from the devil, like stay in the monastery?
So, one of the other pillars of the monastic life, or one of the other characteristics of monasticism, is solitary life. So you have to be separated from the community.
That's where the demons are, the desert.
Yeah, but they know that. The monks and nuns, they know that. They know they're going into their territory, and they're not afraid. Hmm. Does that answer questions?
Why did he go to the tomb to begin with?
This is just something this is what he decided to do. This is what St. Athanasius records in his biography, like I mentioned. I don't know why he decided to do that, but my guess would be that it was a place, because St. Anthony didn't go straight into the desert. He was in the village, and then if you know the life of Anthony, he was actually very close to the village, and one time he actually came across a woman who was bathing in a little pond, and he said, "Don't you see that I'm a monk and you're bathing in front of me?" She said, "If you're a monk, go into the desert." So he actually took her advice. So he slowly moved from the village and then to the cemetery and then out into the desert, into the wilderness. Does that make sense? If you read the life of Anthony, which I recommend everybody should, you'll know a lot about St. Anthony, and you'll actually know where a lot of the monastic teachings come from. So I really encourage you to read the book. Next. All right.
I think it's that part where Jeff said that the devils were bluffing.
Yeah. So they like to make a commotion. They like to scare, you know? So what I think Jeff meant was they were trying to like threaten him or be very intimidating, even though they're really not. The person who has God on their side shouldn't feel intimidated by the devil. Remember Saint Moses the Strong? He was he fell into temptations and sins overnight about 7 times. And then at the end, Saint Isidorus said, "There's more with us than against us." So he pointed to the east and to the west. In the west, he saw a legion of demons, and then he saw in the east a host of angels. So there's more with us than against us. That's a verse in the Bible. I don't know the exact reference. But they like to intimidate us. Anybody who enters the monastic life, and even people in the world, this could happen to them, but it doesn't always happen like this. This is just for the athletes. This is for those high in the spiritual life, and it could even happen with anyone, but this is just an example. This is not how it happens all the time for everyone, you know? This is just an example. So, St. Anthony was what, in the 3rd century, right? Now I'm jumping to monasticism in what? The 7th century. Okay? So this is actually, this icon illustrates this whole book. Okay? Who here knows the monastery in that's called St. Catherine's in Mount Sinai in Egypt? This icon is from that monastery. Okay? And St. John of the Ladder is the one who wrote this book for his monks. So it's a very practical book for monks. Basically, this book has 30 chapters. Okay? Each chapter is literally a step. Okay? So he's saying if you take these 30 steps, what will happen? You'll find yourself in the bosom of God. You would have gone through what the monk needs to go through in the course of his life, and you'd be received into the kingdom. What else do you see here?
Demons trying to make it fall down.
Yeah, you see demons shooting arrows, trying to get them off of what? The ladder. It's okay. So just to give you an idea of what some of the steps are. Some of the steps are, step one is renunciation of life. You don't really need to write all of these things. I'm just giving you an idea. Step two is on detachment. There's a nice teaching. I heard this in one of the monastic lectures. In a nutshell, monasticism is separation from all and attachment to the one, to God. Does that make sense? A monk or a nun is trying to separate themselves from everything, right? And attach themselves to the one. In a nutshell, this is what monasticism is, okay? And then you go on, and then there's a whole bunch of other steps. One of them is poverty, one of them is chastity, one of them is alertness, one of them is vainglory. So there's a whole bunch of steps. So I just wanted to mention that. Okay, next. So this is post-monasticism or contemporary monasticism. I have another handout. We're almost done, by the way. Next. Okay. You're going to get a handout of this, so it's not, you're going to be able to see it. By the way, this is a very valuable resource. This handout right here is very valuable. You're going to know why I think it's very valuable. So, like I said, volume 1 and 2 of the Paradise of the Fathers, in Arabic, was standard Hoban, okay? Was written by Palladius. If you look on yours, you'll see Palladius, okay? He's the one who wrote these, okay? In them, he mentions all of these, most of these monks, okay? So this is basically a monastic genealogy, okay? So by looking at this, you'll know who's disciple to who. That's very valuable information. So one thing that Tant Mary asked me to kind of talk about was how monasticism reached the West. So monasticism was in Egypt, and then it came to the East, like I showed you, and the St. Catherine Monastery actually belongs to the Eastern Orthodox Church. Even though it's in Egypt, it belongs to them. So how did monasticism come to the West? So you're actually going to be very surprised. You see St. Anthony Great up here on the top? Didn't I say his life story was written by Athanasius the Great? Our Pope. He wrote The Life of Anthony, right? Mm. The Life of Anthony made its way to Augustine. St. Augustine, we know him to be somebody who wasn't really good all the time, right? We know his story, that he wasn't always a good guy. You know, he left his house, he started doing a lot of bad things, he lived a very sinful life. He actually read The Life of Anthony, was so moved that he became a monk, he brought monasticism to the West. And he wrote the Confessions. Okay? Some of you guys know that book. If you see Sam Beshoy here, a lot of us know who Sam Beshoy is, right? Sam Beshoy was the disciple of Kambo, who was the disciple of who? Anthony the Great. What I'm trying to show here is everything comes back to Anthony the Great. We should be very proud. We should be very proud that St. Anthony's from Egypt. Very proud. Look at all of this. This all came from one man who was from where? Egypt. Okay? You'll find other names that you're kind of familiar with. Okay? You have Moses the Black right here. And then you have Nicesaurus the Priest. You have St. Macarius the Great. Okay? It's very confusing, right?
What exactly do you mean when you say West?
West? Western world. Okay, the Western world.
Wait, wouldn't the West be like America and us?
It would be like Europe at that time.
Oh, Europe?
Okay.
Oh, Europe.
Right? I believe so, yeah.
Augustine,
you don't live in
America.
No. All right, but moving on. Next. All right, we're almost done. So there's different types of monks. There's solitaries, and there's hermits. Those two terms are interchangeable. Okay? There's anachorites or the spirit born. In Arabic, you probably heard the word. This monk, Hosayah. Sayah means he's spirit born. That means his spirit is over his body, that he can move or she can move in any place.
I thought it was Sawah.
Yeah, Sawah. In English, it's known as spirit born or anachorite. Okay? You have stylites. You see this icon on the right? There's actually monastic people who chose to live their whole life on a pole, on the top of a pole for 40 years. Okay? You have fools for Christ. Who here knows Abuna Abdul Masih al-Manahri? You probably heard of him before. He's a fool for Christ. He acted like he was like not normal, just so that people wouldn't praise him and think that he's a saint. You have the silent ones. Who here knows Abuna Yustus? I'm sure you guys all love these people. These people took these verses and they embodied them. This is all from the Bible, by the way. They took a verse and they flew with it. Okay? So these are different types of monastics. Just because they weren't wearing a kalansoa, which I have one right here. This is a kalansoa. I'm going to talk about it. Just because they weren't wearing this doesn't mean they weren't monks. Does that make sense? Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say?
You know that story of that monk that used to be like a clown? He used to like juggle?
Yeah.
Is he a fool for Christ?
I don't know, but I think...
Wait, you heard of that story?
I heard of it. I know what you're talking about.
He would juggle in front of like the icon of St. Mary.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And like, he would try to like impress her. That's what.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That sounds stupid.
Which group name was the one that lived on the pole?
The stylites.
Well, what do you get out of that?
So basically, I believe it's like another way of being very ascetic within a village. So some of them didn't even leave their villages. And they were just like, they were pretty close, and they decided to like build this pole and let like live on it. And basically, they would let down a basket and just carry food up. I don't know how they did everything else, but that's all I know. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I thought they were the same thing.
I think that's actually that term, it's like misused actually. Anachorite and solitary are usually anachorite and spirit born are used interchangeably, but I'm pretty sure that it's separate from hermits or solitaries. Hermits and solitaries are muwahhidin. It's a wahid. Okay, in Arabic. Anachorites and spirit-born are like I said, they're the ones that their spirit is way stronger than their body because they feed their spirit, they're praying, they're fasting, and they bring the body down. Okay, they mortify the body. And that's why their spirit has this ability over their body. Okay? Next. So there's three monastic orders. There's the order of St. Anthony, like I said, which is the solitary life, okay? There's the order of St. Shenouda, okay? The order of St. Shenouda is basically a monastery, a community of monks who live in this monastery, who have their private prayers, okay? But at the same time, they go and serve the community and come back. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And the third one is the Order of St. Bachomius, which is known as the Canonia. That's basically what we have today. It's a bunch of monks or nuns living in a monastery or a convent, eating together, praying together, and then they have their separate time for personal prayer. So these days, we have most of our monasteries are this order, the order of St. Bachomius.
What is any monastery with St. Anthony's order?
So within a monastery, you'll have monks who are solitaries.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they're living that life, even though they belong to a monastery.
And there's also like people that like don't get out of like their room.
Yes. They would still be considered a solitary because they're embracing that lifestyle.
Yeah, someone like, I didn't see him.
Yeah.
Well, there's monasteries of the Order of St. Shenouda. Like, a monk is supposed to be not in the world, but they can go out every once in a while and, like, feed the poor.
Yeah, this order, actually, we actually have a monastery like this in Rochester, New York. If you guys know Abuna Shenouda Meher, he has a monastery under this order. These monks, they live in the monastery, but at the same time, they're very active in the community and they come back. Okay?
So it's pretty much a priest, but...
It's almost like a priest serving the community and coming back and still being like a monk. So there is currently... This is actually being revived in our church. Abuna Shenouda Meher, he's in Rochester. He's a priest that's actually trying to revive this order of monasticism. Okay? And it's attributed to St. Shenouda. The Archmandrite.
What's the koinonia?
The koinonia is, I believe, a Greek word for fellowship.
Is that in a way like bottling up their spiritual richness? Like, don't they like want to share that with everyone?
That's a great question and comment. Of course, these people have a lot to offer to the world, but they are very focused on God and Christ, and it's not like a greedy thing. Like, they don't want to share with the world and they don't want to serve. No, they're just too caught up in what they're trying. They're very in contact with God. And this is a calling, by the way. It's not like these people, they need to get this permission and blessing to do this. It's not like a monk just decides to go do this. So most monks these days, they have to spend X amount of years before they're granted this blessing of becoming a solitary. It's not given to anyone. In the early monastic life of the church, this was happening. Like, you had a lot of solitaries. But all these formalities, all these like rules, started getting developed later, because the monastic life was like, it was oral teaching, right? It was just being passed down. Remember that big genealogy?
Yeah.
You basically had an elder father teaching the novice. The novice is one who wants to become a monk. Okay? He would teach him. He would be discipled to him. These days, it's very different. The system has changed. Monasteries are very big, and there's a lot of literature, there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of opinions. So these things are not like set in stone. Like, there are some monks that, for example, I'll tell you a nice story that I read. It's in one of these books. There was a few solitaries that lived close to each other. But because they wanted to maintain their sanity, they decided every, like, once a month to drink a cup of tea with each other and then part. It's not like a set-in-stone rule. Do you get what I mean? There's still some free... Like, there's still some, exceptions. Does that make sense? These rules are not, like, not followed to the T like that. Like, they could serve if it's in them to serve. And there's another story of two monks, and they're walking, right? And they encounter a lady, and I believe she's trying to get across the river or something. So one of the monks helps her. He actually swims with her across the river, and then takes her to the other side. So the other monk's like, "Do you know what you just did?" This is after he did that for her. He's like, "You just carried this woman... and you know the rules of the monks, and you know all this stuff." And this, the other monk said, "I carried her physically, but you're carrying her in your heart." Okay? So monasticism isn't always like this straight to the T rules like we think it is. It's more of a spiritual matter. It's really about the intent, the motive of the heart, if that makes sense. Okay? Okay, next. So, I had mentioned, I had touched on a few of these. Monasticism, in a nutshell, is three things. These are the pillars of monasticism. Obedience, chastity, and voluntary poverty. These people chose to be poor. They choose to be a chaste person. They choose to be obedient. Okay, these things are not forced on them. They choose to embrace them. They choose to love them. These are their friends. Okay? This is just a cool icon that I came across. I don't know if you could read it, but it says... Basically, it's just saying, like... It's basically saying Christ, the angels are looking to Christ, the monks are looking to the angels, and the people of the world look to the monks as something higher. You know, they're our example. You know what I mean? So when we see a monk, we're like, wow, this is somebody living a very holy life, and we take them as our examples. So that's what this icon is trying to do here. So it's a very nice way of like reminding us that these are people we should be looking up to. Next. I didn't even finish this slide. Basically, what I'm trying to do here is kind of talk about what a monk does in his day, a monk or a nun. In most monasteries, you wake up 4 a.m., you do tazbaha, and then after that, you go to the liturgy. Okay, so from 4 to 6 is tazbaha, and then liturgy is from 8 to 10 or something like that. Or no, 6 to 8 is divine liturgy, and then from 8 to noon is work and prayer, and then they pray some more, and they do some more things, and then it's vespers, asheya, and then... That's usually their day. But the morning part of their day is very busy.
You know, they don't eat.
Yeah. No, they eat. Somewhere in there. They usually eat once or twice a day. No more than that. Okay, next. I think this is the last slide. This is just a map of where most of the monasteries are located. You guys know Wadi Natron?
Yes.
This is a map of Egypt. This is where Wadi Natron is. There's four monasteries there right now. There's the Embe Beshoy Monastery. There's Deir Suryan. Deir Abu Ma'ar, St. Macarius. And the Baramos, the Syrian monastery. Yeah, they're all very close to each other. And this is where a lot of the monasteries actually originated. And then St. Anthony's Monastery is here. So I just wanted to give you an idea of where all of these monasteries are located. I think that's the last slide.
St. Anthony's one.
Yeah, test it. Questions?
St. Anthony's monastery is one of the biggest I saw.
Yeah.
A church is consecrated, but is a monastery consecrated?
Yeah.
It could be by a bishop or...
Same. Yeah, it's the same thing as the church.
Come on.
It would be consecrated by a bishop. Because each monastery has many altars... And they need to be consecrated. They have many altars, they have many icons, and all of that kind of stuff. So, any other questions? I'm sorry, it was like all over the place. That's tried. Okay, glory be to God. Oh, Tony is asking about this. This is in English, this is a cowl. In Arabic, it's a kalansowa. Okay, this is the head garment of a monk. Okay? There's some meaning to it. There's a lot of meaning to it, actually. The first thing, let me start with the first one. It didn't always look like this. At the time of Saint Anthony, it was just black. I don't think he had a cross embroidered in it, okay? But there's a story where St. Anthony took his black cowl and he put it on a stick and he hid behind a rock and he saw the devils shooting arrows at his garment. So he started laughing. He said, these devils are so frustrated even by my clothing. They can't even stand the clothing I wear. So he went to go get his Kalansoa, and the devils grabbed the other side and it ripped. So St. Anthony, because he has more muscles, he managed to get it out of the devil's hand, and he sewed it. So that's how we get that line. So every time you see this line, that's literally what it means. And these 12 crosses, there's 6 crosses on this side, 6 crosses on that side. 6 plus 6 is what? 12? It's a symbol, or it simplifies the 12 disciples. And the cross on the back is Christ. Okay? We didn't always have this in the Coptic Church, but we revived it. Pope Shenouda revived it from the Armenian Church. Okay? So that's a little bit of information on this. So this is what the monks wear today. They didn't always wear this.
I remember my question. My question was, like, I think I heard when Pope Shenouda became Pope, he like toughened up on the monks and he made them all have, like, you know, bachelor's and college degrees. Like, can you explain more about how they were before and what Shenouda did?
Yeah, so and like Tony said, I believe in the like early 20th century,